Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church, on the web at ignatius.com.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, we're talking about two saintly popes and an upcoming canonization. Jeanette DiMello will be here talking with author Joanna Bogle about Pope John Paul II, also Matthew Bunsen about Pope John the 23rd. They're both going to be canonized on April 27th of next year, and that, by the way, is Divine Mercy Sunday. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DiMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. How are you, Jeanette?
Hello, Tom.
Good to hear your voice and that of our next guest, Joanna Bogle. She is an author, journalist, and broadcaster living in London. Joanna writes for various newspapers and magazines in Britain, America, and Australia. Joanna's books include A Book of Seasons and Celebrations, which is linked to a series on EWTN. She's also authored or co-authored a number of historical biographies, as well as children's fiction under the great pen name Julia Blythe, one of which is titled Blessed John Paul the Great. How about that? Joanna appears regularly on the BBC and other TV and radio stations. She has recently filmed an EWTN television series in Poland about the life of John Paul II, and she co-authored with Claire Anderson a book about him. Both the TV series and the book are expected to reach his audiences next spring, just in time for the canonization of John Paul the Great. And I personally was blessed to see our friend Joanna this summer at our EWTN family celebration. Joanna, welcome to Register Radio. Glad you're on with us today.
It's lovely to be back. Hi.
Howdy.
Joanna, it's so great to be talking to you again. This summer when we spoke, we knew that John Paul II would be canonized sometime in the next year, but we didn't know when. So on September 30th, the cardinals met in Rome in a consistory, and they voted on the date of the canonization of both Pope John XXIII and also Pope John Paul II. And the date's now set. It's April 27th, 2014. It's the Feast of the Divine Mercy, and that is a very important day in the life of Pope John Paul, and I'm hoping that you can tell us why this Divine Mercy Sunday is such an important day.
I certainly can. I think for all of us, the whole idea of John Paul being canonized is at one level just what we expected, and at another level, a really quite extraordinary thing, because it's a relatively short time. Mm-hmm. They said Santo Subito at his funeral, a great call from the crowd. And it has been Subito. He's been made a pope, really fairly, made a saint, really quite quickly. Not the most quick. I think Francis of Assisi was quicker and so on. But it really is a very exciting thing. Divine Mercy, yes. Claire and I, we're working on this book about John Paul, due out in the spring, had the privilege of being at the Divine Mercy Shrine and while we were filming in Poland. And this is an enormously significant part of what John Paul gave to the Church and the world. This understanding of God's mercy, well, obviously it's not new, it's central to our Christian faith. But the particular understanding of it, the new richness of it, is rather like the richness brought by Margaret Marie Alacoque in her understanding of the Sacred Heart back in the 17th century. A nun, Sister Faustina Kowalska, in Poland, in a convent on the outskirts of Krakow, received these sort of messages from our Lord about his mercy, the infinite mercy of God. And it's really something that was needed in the ghastly 20th century when there was just oceans of blood. You think of the Gulag, you think of the concentration camps under Hitler. All of this divine mercy thing was happening within miles of Auschwitz, not so far away. There was the horror of Stalin's Poland taking over people's hearts and minds with communism. This was the idea all about to happen post-war. Mercy. God's mercy. It's terribly important. And it was a great devotion that John Paul, as Archbishop of Krakow when he was just Cardinal Wojtyła, really helped to promote.
And he named the Feast of the Divine Mercy on this particular Sunday, and that I think it was in 2001, and he died on the eve of this day. So it really is an important day. And You just returned from Poland, as you mentioned, and you know so many people around the world got to experience Pope John Paul II during his papal trips. He went to 129 countries during his papacy, but you just had the chance to visit Poland and to really walk in the footsteps of Pope John Paul. Can you tell us what you learned while you were there that might have been different from what you knew before of him?
Yes, he came very sort of close to us in this time. I know Poland a little bit. I've been to Krakow for quite a few times. And in fact, my first experience was long, long ago in the 1980s when I was, as a number of us were in those days, smuggling in books and things for Solidarity, all very exciting. I remember I had the addresses of the contacts pinned inside my clothes and all this kind of thing, very thrilling at the time. Not dangerous for me, but dangerous for them, so one was very anxious to get it right. And here is a very different Krakow, a very different Krakow. And I've been back a few times, so it's just very thriving. Cafes, restaurants, shops, young people having a good time, very much a university city, lots of young people. But you feel very close to John Paul there. This was the city he knew and loved. And his big picture is still there in the big window from which he spoke to the young people in Franciscana Street, the palace of the Archbishop. But the word palace is wrong, really, because it's just a sort of great big cozy house in a way. Mm-hmm. We had a long morning with Cardinal Zivic, such a nice man, really good, and he was telling us about John Paul, a very intimate thing. I remember he finished by saying he was a saint, he was a saint. And out there in the street, when you look up and there's John Paul beaming down. I say his picture is still there. It's a brand new picture that's been put up because that's always going to be his window. That's where he leaned out and bantered with the young people and sang. And then, of course, there's a glorious statue of him at Wawel Cathedral. There's, I don't think, a single church that doesn't have his picture. Where he was a young curate in St. Florian's, there's a marvelous portrait of him as a young priest. That's absolutely beautiful. And then, of course, when you fly in, it's John Paul Airport. And then, about 40 minutes away down the main road, there's Wadowice, where he was born and brought up. And oddly, I hadn't kind of realized this until I went there. His house was right next to the church. You could almost lean out of the kitchen window and touch the church wall, kind of almost prophetic that this boy was going to be a priest. And it was there this little boy grew up, rather a sad childhood in a way. His mother died, and then his beloved older brother died. But he and his father, a soldier, were very, very much a team and a great deal of love there. And his father taught him a sort of manly piety, very much giving us the boy, the man, the priest, the pope. I mean, it's a marvelous story.
It is a marvelous story, and it is a beautiful place. I've also seen that same place that you were talking about, and I hope that many pilgrims will get to see it when World Youth Day is in Poland in a few years. I think that would be a great opportunity for many. Now, Pope John Paul, his legacy is large, and I'm sure that in this book that you are trying to narrow it down into chapters or something like that. And can you fill me in on what those chapters might be so we get a glimpse of what his legacy is about? Just, you know, five things or so that we can, or three to five things we can say are a part of his legacy.
It is difficult, isn't it? And incidentally, the finest book on the subject is, of course, George Weigel's brilliant Witness to Hope, which I cannot recommend too highly. It's a magnificent piece of work. He's a fine biographer who came to love and admire John Paul, and it's an excellent read. Mm-hmm. We're looking at different aspects of John Paul. I was looking at John Paul and Mary. He gave us a very rich Marian theology, a deep understanding of Mary and also the church as a woman. And this has some bearing also on his understanding of the role of women, the importance of women, that beautiful letter to women he wrote, Mulieris Dignitatem. So I would say there's a whole very interesting development there. The church had not really grasped the great reality of modern womanhood. And John Paul met women very easily and on easy, friendly terms. He and also Pope Benedict are really the first popes in modern times to do so, taking it for granted that women would have, you know, university degree and would bustle around outside the home as well as in it. Great reverence for motherhood. Great reverence also for the role of a woman in commerce, in public life. And there's a whole lot there that I thought was fascinating. So it's John Paul and women. I would say John Paul and the great healing with the Jewish community. That's such a beautiful thing. His friendship with Jerzy Kluger, boyhood friendship, and then the horror of what happened to the Jews, especially in Poland. in World War II. But more than that, a very, very sort of deep theological understanding of Israel and the church, unexplored territory for too long. And somebody described this as sort of picking up a dialogue that had sort of stopped almost 2,000 years ago. And I think there's something very deep there. Again, very much in tandem with Josef Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, very deep stuff. Lots more to unpack there. Very beautiful. And incidentally, a very strong message against anti-Semitism. And I hadn't realized that was needed. It formed no part of my life at all, but I have met as a Catholic journalist, horrible stuff sent to me, dirty anti-Jewish stuff purporting to be from such as Catholics, and it was horrible stuff. So I love John Paul and that. But that would be another one. I think we'd also have to look at John Paul and Poland. He's very much a man of place. He taught us that you love your country without sort of being nationalistic. Patriotism is right in there with loving your mother and your father. It's a deep love of what you've been given and a loyalty to it. And it's bound up with love of neighbor. And there's a largeness in it. This teaches you to love all. It's love and service. And just as we honor our parents, it's all part of the fourth commandment. And his love of the Tatra Mountains and the Vistula River and the way he incorporated his love of Poland into a love of the goodness of God, the great gifts he's given us. You know, I think to have a pope who was so much associated with a place is absolutely lovely. And one of the things that I learned was I love England. I love it so dearly. And I realize it is a noble and beautiful thing to love your country. And you have to really put that in its right perspective of service to all mankind and great gratitude to God for the diversity he's given us. I mean, that's all gorgeous stuff. So I think those are three things, but there's an awful lot more, too. I mean, it's just massive in John Paul's life.
Yes, it is massive in John Paul's life, and I know a lot of Polish people are going to be flocking to Rome for the canonization. That's expected to be a very, very huge event, and I'm sure you'll be there. I hope that I'd be there for that event. Mm. WTN will certainly be covering it. But,
it'd
Joanna, we're just out of time, and I want to thank you so much. We look forward to your book, and people can find more information about you where?
Oh, if they Google my name or they can look up my blog, Auntie Joanna Writes. I'm known as Auntie Joanna, so anytime just Google Auntie Joanna Writes and you'll get me.
Gotta love that. And I know that your book is going to be offered by EWTN Religious Catalog, and that'll be in the spring, right?
Yes, it will. We're working on it now, even as we speak. I'm seeing Claire later this week to finalize this and that chapter.
Wonderful. Joanna Bogle, thank you so much for joining us today. We always love hearing from you. God bless you.
God bless you. Cheerios.
When we return, we'll talk with Matthew Bunsen about the other pope soon to be canonized, John the 23rd. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
John at Bankovic talks about the National Catholic Register.
I recommend the National Catholic Register to all Catholics who want to discover what it means to live their faith in this our day and time. We get the clear, unbiased news of today because the National Catholic Register takes its cue from the mind and the heart of the Church. It really becomes a tool by which we are able to live that abundant life in Jesus Christ and to share that life with others. The National Catholic Register seeks to meet people where they are, seeks to meet people where they are in their walk of faith, where they are practically in their lives at the moment.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the register or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the register subscription banner or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DiMello, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Matthew Bunsen, is one of the United States' leading authorities on the papacy and the church. He is a church historian and author. He's appeared as a guest on MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, here on EWTN, and on France 24. Matthew is a senior fellow of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Some of his books include The Encyclopedia of Catholic History, The Encyclopedia of Saints, Papal Wisdom, and the Pope Encyclopedia. He is here today to talk with us about the soon-to-be canonized Pope John the 23rd, who initiated the Second Vatican Council some 50 years ago. He is commonly known as the Good Pope. Matthew, welcome back to Register Radio.
Oh, it is great to be with you. And what is, I think, for all of us in the Church, a really joyous occasion, the announcement of the impending canonizations of both John the 23rd and, of course, John Paul II the Great.
Absolutely.
That's so true. I know that on September 30th is when this announcement was made public. It was made official that the date of this canonization is April 27th, 2014, which is the Feast of the Divine Mercy. It had a special place in the life of Pope John Paul II. But we're here to talk to you about Pope John the 23rd. And to be honest, I don't know of a lot about Pope John the 23rd, except that he started the Council, the Second Vatican Council, and that he is called the Good Pope John. So that's why we're having you on the show, Matthew, who's
sure.
written the Pope Encyclopedia. So tell us just a little bit about the man, the background of this man, Pope John the 23rd.
Yeah, well, John the 23rd, of course, came as a huge surprise to the world at the time of his election in 1958, as successor to the magnificent and long-reigning Pope Pius the 12th. It's not generally known that he was a close collaborator for decades with Pope Pius. John was born Angelo Roncalli, of course, in the Diocese of Bergamo, and really earned his stripes, so to speak, as a papal diplomat. He served for a time as a medic, as a chaplain in the Italian army during World War I, and then he was called to assist the Vatican Diplomatic Corps. And he really received some of the most difficult postings around, especially during the war. He served, for example, in Turkey and Istanbul. And then he was the papal ambassador to France from all the way from 1944. So imagine occupied France after the war to 1953. In those posts, he, as I was saying, worked very closely with Pope Pius XII to help bring peace to a shattered Europe, to begin the process of rebuilding Europe and the rest of the world spiritually and materially. And what is not generally known is that he worked so aggressively, again, this is crucial, in close cooperation with Pius XII to save as many Jews as they could from Nazi oppression and the Holocaust.
Wow, that's a very little known fact. So that's a very, very interesting fact. And I know he also wrote several encyclicals. One of them was Pacem in Terris. It's probably his most well-known.
Yeah, it is. Along with Mater et Magistra, Pacem in Terris really stands as one of the great social encyclicals. The title, of course, means peace on earth, and it was really the first encyclical ever addressed to all men, all people of goodwill, as well as to Catholics. And he grounds the Church's teachings on peace in natural law. He called on the world, especially at that particular moment. We're talking in the 1960s. The world had been divided up after World War II, and we were looking at the Cold War. You had the Soviet Union. You had the oppressed states behind the Iron Curtain. You had communist China on the rise, and then you had the free world, which itself, though, was struggling with issues, again, emerging out of that Second World War, of materialism, of the sort of existential despair that came out of so many components and elements of the Second World War. So he was reminding the world of what authentic peace is, and again, grounded that in the teachings of the Church on what the Church actually means by what is peace in natural law, as I was saying. And then with Mater et Magistra, on Christianity and social progress, he really recapitulated, he updated and extended the social teachings that were presented so wonderfully by Leo XIII and then picked up in a lot of ways where Pius XI left off with his teachings on the social teachings of the Church, again, at a time of immense change and upheaval in the world. So in that sense, too, he was very prophetic in proclaiming to the world what the world actually needs for peace and progress, and really what the Second Vatican Council was working on.
Sure. So he was prophetic in many ways. Obviously, the Second Vatican Council was something that he started. This was in October 1962. He opened the Second Vatican Council, and he actually died less than a year later. So this is really a prophetic thing. Tell us about the thought that went into starting the Second Vatican Council.
Yeah, well, he famously said that he made the decision to convoke the Second Vatican Council on the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And it was something that he believed the Church needed at the time. And, of course, there had been discussions in the pontificate of Pope Pius XII of the potential need for an ecumenical council, but the world still recovering from the Second World War, shattered as it was, the conditions weren't right. John, however, understood that in order for the world to benefit, in order for the world to mature spiritually, the Church needed to be positioned to engage with the modern world in much the same way, of course, that we talk today about the new evangelization. And in his opening address to the Second Vatican Council, Pope John so memorably said that it is the function of this council to help the Church to take her unchanging teachings, the crucial teachings that the world so desperately needs, unchanged, defended, but then out into the world in a language and in a way that the modern world can comprehend. And, of course, that's the great process and progress of evangelization throughout the whole history of the Church. So he was really positioning the Church to confront and to dialogue with modernity, which, of course, is what we've been doing ever since. I mean, John Paul II built on that, Pope Benedict XVI built on that, and now Pope Francis has too. So in that sense, the council really was a source for John of reform, of renewal, but also of preparation for the Church, especially at a time when the Church was exploding globally. You know, he issued an encyclical on the missionary activity of the Church. He established native hierarchies in far-flung regions that would have been unimaginable just a few decades before. Think of Indonesia, Vietnam, and Korea. Mm-hmm. So he recognized that we were now a global Church, and he needed to help the Church prepare for the coming of the modern age and to prepare even for the 21st century.
This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking with author and theologian Matthew Bunsen about Pope John the 23rd. Now, Matthew, in a way, many people see Pope John the 23rd as being somewhat controversial because of the Second Vatican Council. It's a sad thing, but could he have even seen what was to follow the Second Vatican Council, all of the misinterpretation of the council that followed in the kind of the last 50 years?
The reality is that we cannot blame the council. We can't blame the council documents, the teachings coming out of the council, for some of the confusion and misinterpretations that followed. John's teachings were incredibly clear. As I said, his opening address to the council was absolutely unambiguous about what his objective was. And in that sense, it has been one of the unfortunate aspects that in the two decades or so that followed the council, there was this misinterpretation, what we now call the hermeneutics of continuity and reform versus the hermeneutics of rupture, the idea that nothing before the council mattered and that only what followed the council, or at least what they interpreted the council to mean, mattered. Whereas I think John would be very pleased with the work of especially John Paul II and Benedict XVI in steering the Church toward that authentic interpretation. Sure. What I would argue is the very faithful interpretation of what John himself intended the Council to accomplish. And we can see the fruits of that in the pontificate of John Paul II, the continuing development of the Church around the globe, the maturing of the Church in all of those different corners of the globe.
Now, Pope Francis has said that it is because of the Second Vatican Council, because of his initiation of it and what he intended for it, that he is being canonized. It's usually required two miracles for canonization. He has one, and yet the Pope has kind of waived that precedent, and it's not unheard of, but it's rare that happens. Tell us about the spirituality of this man, because that's why people are canonized.
Yeah, well, when we think of one of the great hallmarks of the Second Vatican Council is a universal call to holiness. All of us are called to holiness, to be saints. And John understood that. In his lifetime, he was somebody of immense, profound depth spiritually. His autobiography, Journal of the Soul, is considered one of the spiritual classics of the second half of the 20th century. And he himself was noted for his practical good humor, his practical pastoral sense, but also for his deep prayer life and his own pursuit of the perfection of the virtues, which, as we all know, that the perfection of the virtues to a heroic degree is one of those key elements in the determination of someone's canonization. Was this person living a life of virtue heroically? And it was clear that John was doing that. Mm-hmm. His commitment to the council, I think, reflected his desire for that universal holiness to assist the church in speaking to the modern world and bringing the gospel and bringing Christ to the modern world very effectively. So I think that's where Francis sort of ties the council to John's holiness. His last year was filled with immense suffering. He was, of course, very old. He was about 77 or so when he was elected pope, and he was facing health issues and then, of course, had stomach cancer. And that really slowly took its time in bringing great suffering. And he died quite literally with the prayer on his lips. And in that sense, too, he is a model for all of us that he worked and prayed right to the very end and was a model, I think, for the bishops who served in the council fathers, and for the members of the College of Cardinals who chose his successor, who were very cognizant of his suffering, but also his hope that what he saw the Second Vatican Council accomplishing would continue with his successor, and of course it did with Pope Paul VI.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much. We're out of time, and I'm so grateful that you've taught us about John the 23rd. We'll have to have you on to talk a lot more about this soon-to-be saint. So thanks very much.
It's a privilege to be with you. I love being here, and any time that I can help. God bless.
Thank you, Matthew. I know that your books are available pretty much just about anywhere, but people can follow what you're doing by going to salvationhistory.com, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Very good. Thank you so much.
God bless.
Thank you. Don't forget you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Just look for the microphone to listen to or download the show. Thanks again for joining us here on Register Radio. For all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church. On the web at ignatius.com.